From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In a book, Novella Carpenter describes her farm, which is on a dead-end street in a ghetto of West Oakland, California. Her apartment was next to an abandoned lot. It's what first attracted her to the place. And over time, she started to grow vegetables there and then to raise animals in her yard. It wasn't exactly legal, but Carpenter says she used the anarchy of the place to her advantage. There were drug dealers there and prostitutes, people selling weed, so she figured for the police there were other things to worry about other than her Swiss chard and her goats. Well, the city didn't always look the other way, and it's been complicated trying to keep her farm together. Today in the program, Novella Carpenter will join us to talk about her book, a memoir called Farm City. It's about the challenges and gifts and the life of an urban farmer. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Novella Carpenter's book about keeping an urban farm in West Oakland, California, became a bestseller. And along with the recognition came attention to her farm, to the vegetables she grew in an abandoned lot, and the animals she kept in her yard. It wasn't exactly legal, but Carpenter says she used the anarchy of the place to her advantage. There were drug dealers there and prostitutes, so she figured for the police or for city officials there were other things to worry about rather than her rabbits and goats. Well, the city didn't always look the other way, and it's been complicated trying to keep her farm together. In her book, she says this is about control. Whoever can grow their food at their residence holds some power, some control. Her book is called Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. And today on the program, Novella Carpenter is joining us to talk about the book and the things she's learned over the years of gardening, farming, we should say. Novella Carpenter is a freelance journalist whose work has appeared in Mother Jones and Salon.com, among others. Her book is called, as we said, Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. And she's joining us today from the School of Journalism at Berkeley. And Novella Carpenter, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, I guess I wanted to start with what the book is and what the book isn't, because I know you've been thinking about writing a sort of a how-to be an urban farmer, but we should say Farm City isn't that. I mean, it's your reflections on how you sort of became one, but it's not really a how-to manual. Is it fair
no.
to say that?
Yeah, it's definitely fair. You know, I run an urban farm store in Berkeley now, and I had a woman come in and she was like, oh, I'm raising ducks now. And then she's like, does your book contain duck information?
Right.
I'm like, boy, you'd really have to wade through it in order to get some duck information. But I did. I am writing it. I actually just completed a how-to book. So it is coming out next spring.
Oh, good. Okay.
But Farm City is definitely a memoir. It's my story. It's how I did things. You know, I'm a trial and error farmer. It's not like I'm an expert. And so a lot of this is, you know, the early years of learning how to farm.
I want to ask you about the place, because in some ways this is about – a lot of this is about identity and not just your identity, which you write about, but also the identity of Oakland in some ways. And you say that every second – in the book you say every second-rate city has an identity complex. Oakland is no different. Talk about that if you would.
Well, you know, Oakland's right across the bridge from San Francisco. And, you know, San Francisco is, you know, this city in America's mind of, you know, luxury and beauty and sort of the dot-com world maybe. And then there's Oakland, which is kind of the scruffy second cousin of San Francisco maybe. It's definitely had its share of problems and crime being, you know, a major part of Oakland's identity. But I do want to say, you know, Oakland doesn't – you know, there are really nice neighborhoods in Oakland, like really nice neighborhoods. But, you know, for the most part, you know, it goes along with being – people just think, oh, it's, you know, be careful. Don't go to Oakland, you know. And I'm always the kind of person that's like, oh, if someone tells me not to go somewhere, I'm there. I'm going there for sure. And so that's how I ended up living in Oakland and loving Oakland, really, because – Well, unlike San Francisco, it's not a postcard. You know, it's not like living in a postcard. It's very real. People are very friendly and open, and they'll tell you what who they think you are, and you'll have a good conversation about those things. So a lot of Farm City is about struggling with my identity through the lens of Oakland, because Oakland is such a kaleidoscope of different cultures and immigrant groups and ethnicities. And, you know, as a white girl from Seattle, I'm sort of like, what is my culture? Yeah. You know, it made me question those things. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting you talk about, I mean, you spent the first, you're pretty young, 6 years of your life anyway in Idaho. And you talk about your parents, sort of these back to the land hippies, I guess, who had a ranch in Idaho for a time. And you say that this urge to raise and even to, I guess, to kill animals for food was part of your cultural DNA. What did you mean by that? It was just sort of something that came to you, that it was sort of embedded in you? You got it from your parents, or was there something else going on?
Well, I mean, I think everyone actually has it in them. If you're human, I mean, maybe not vegans, and God bless them, but I think a lot of people have a connection to animals and their food. And so I think that there's just a cultural connection. I mean, that's why so many people have dogs and cats, right? They want to have a connection to the natural world, so natural in quotes, the natural world. For me, yeah, my parents were hippies and they grew a lot of their own food. And my mom would always tell me these stories about, you know, raising the milk cow and raising turkeys and these kinds of things. And so those kind of stories stuck with me. A lot of, I think, cultural identity is the stories that people tell each other around the dinner table. And so I started to sort of examine that. I had become a real city person. Mm. I went to Safeway, I bought my food, my meat in a wrapped package, and I never really thought about it any further. And then when I moved to Oakland, I really felt like there was a strong community of other people that were urban farmers on one side, which was very supportive. And then on the other, I just started to have a curiosity about where my food comes from and where exactly was this meat wrapped in this package from and what had its life been like. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of why I started to struggle with, you know, these issues. I'd been a vegetarian for years, and I started to think, well, what if I, you know, I think the best way to know what meat is to actually raise it and kill it yourself. Yeah. And so I did that with my first animal was a Thanksgiving turkey, because, you know, there's nothing more American than raising a turkey, right? Yeah. even vegetarians are going to eat a little turkey on Thanksgiving. And so that's how I got it first started.
Well, I wanted to maybe get you to read a section from the book about this. This is Harold. I have to say that what's so kind of lovely about it is, and difficult as well, which I'm guessing you of course understand. I mean, this was not easy. And Harold had a companion who was killed. I just wanted you to talk about this experience with Harold, because and we won't actually have you read the section where you do kill him, but this is the part as you're leading up to it, and maybe say something about this. And I don't know how much setup we need to have for this part, I guess, because that's what it is. But
right. Well, I mean, I would. Okay, so I would say for this scene, you know, the setup is really that. I had gotten these. I'd ordered poultry through the mail. Yeah. They had come in this little box, and there were these, you know, little turkey poults in the box. And you know, I was sort of freaked out. I was like, oh my God, what have I gotten into? But then, you know, the turkey poults grew, and everything seemed fine. And my vegan neighbor, Lana, came over one day. And, you know, I had been a farmer. I'd prided myself on not naming these turkeys, right? And Lana immediately saw the, you know, an advantage. And so she was like, Harold and Maude. Yeah. And so, you know, from the movie. So I had these named turkeys all of a sudden, which to my horror, you know, I was hoping to be a farmer and I was just going to name them breakfast, lunch, and dinner or something like that. But there you go. So then all of a sudden Harold took on this personality and had emotions. And I recognized this fact, which is pretty tough if you're thinking about preparing this bird for Thanksgiving dinner. But at the same time, from the moment that I had met this turkey when it was 1 day old, it was planned to be a meal. Yeah. So this is sort of me struggling with issues as I'm sitting there. It's a couple days before Thanksgiving, yeah. And it's time. Harold and I, there in that squat lot, embodied the latest endpoint of centuries of mutual dependence. The reason Harold existed at all was that he and his ancestors had made a Faustian bargain with humans, guaranteed food, shelter, and the opportunity to pass on their genes in exchange, eventually, for their life. Paradoxically, to be killed was a way of life for Harold. Though Harold had become a postmodern turkey, named, citified, his death, when viewed in the context of his species, was part of being a turkey. As the naturalist Stephen Budinsky points out in The Covenant of the Wild, quote, all of nature's strategies for the survival of a species, strategies which include domestication, include suffering and death of individual members of that species, end quote. Harold's mother, some breeding hen at Murray McMurray Hatchery, lives on. In an indirect way, Harold's mother and I were cooperating so that we could both survive. Of course, we were meat-eating city dwellers that don't have to kill something to survive. We were merely going to the store with some cash in hand. How many people would eat meat if they had to kill it themselves? This was a question I had pondered for 6 months as I watched Harold grow from a puffy chick into a full-grown turkey. I eat meat. I like eating meat. It is part of my culture, and some might argue my heritage as a human being. While Harold had to die, I had to kill. At the grocery counter farmer's market stall, the cost of meat I had bought factored in the cost of the bird's life, feed, housing, transportation to market. A small portion of that cost included a kill fee. I had been comfortable allowing someone else to be my executioner. And suddenly, all the meat I had bought, even though I had considered it expensive at the time, seemed underpriced. We burned a little tobacco in an oyster shell, as a New Agey friend had recommended. She said it was the Native American tradition that showed the animal spirit which way was up. The Kung people, a hunter-gatherer tribe in Africa, asked for forgiveness of an animal's spirit. Budansky tells us, quote, they don't pretend there is no ethical cost or guilt even inherent in the act of killing the animal, end quote. With this in mind, I whispered into Harold's ear my thanks and asked for forgiveness. Although I call myself an atheist, a lonely universe offers little comfort to a person confronting death. I thought of my father, a voracious hunter and fisherman, who, even after my mom left him, never came back from the land. He had tried in his subtle way, from a great distance, to instill in me some of his beliefs about nature as a god of sorts. In my life as a city dweller, though, pantheism had mostly eluded me. But to hold Harold, this amazing living creature, and to know that his life force would be transferred to me in the form of food felt sacred. I stroked his warm, warty head. The folds of his skin were soft and pliable, punctuated with small, wayward hairs. I could feel his heart beating slowly. It's true that eating meat springs from a violent act, that in that way meat is like murder. But it is not filled with hate. I had murdered an opossum that had murdered some of my ducks, just some backstory. But Harold, I had raised in a loving, compassionate way, with good food, sunshine, and plenty of exercise. Harold had had a good life, and now he would have a good death, quick, painless, at the hands of someone he knew in a familiar place.
You know, it made me wonder, what's the pressure of cooking an animal when you go through something like that? I mean, it's got to be, it's one thing to overcook or ruin a turkey you get from the supermarket, right?
Oh, it totally changes it, changes everything. There's a real paranoia. You know, they say there's a quote, angels send meat and devils send cooks. But, you know, so I've always tried to sort of ally myself with the best cooks that I can find to help me prepare the food that I've raised myself, especially because of that factor that, you know, God, you just want to make sure it's good. Harold was an amazing turkey. actually consulted a couple because he was a heritage turkey, a heritage breed turkey. He had to be cooked in a different way. It wasn't like a butterball where you just, you know, pop him in the oven for, you know, hours and hours. So it was a really quick cook.
Yeah.
And he was amazing. And that sort of anything that you raise yourself, I mean, anyone that grows vegetables knows this. You know, the carrot that you pulled out of the garden that you grew, that you planted and watered, it's always going to taste better, even if, you know, somebody else, if there was a blind taste test, maybe, you know, people would decide it wasn't the best carrot. But just the knowing actually makes the food taste so much better.
It's so interesting the way the book talks about death, experiencing the death of some of your animals. I mentioned Maude, Harold's companion, you know, killed by neighborhood dogs. And you, you referred to the opossum who killed some of your ducks and geese. That I have to say, that was such an interesting moment in the book because there's this paradox going on. I mean, you are so furious at this opossum,
because
you come upon him and you kill him. I mean,
And
you say in the book that you were kind of shocked to see a kind of wildness in yourself that you really didn't know you had this in you, and it wasn't about hate necessarily, but there was a kind of, I don't know what it was, a kind of rage.
No, it was
almost
a murderous rage.
Yeah.
It was a murderous rage. But, you know, if any farmer knows that if you've had an animal kill your livestock and you catch that animal in the act, pretty much unless you're a complete pacifist, you're going to reach for your gun or you're going to do something, because it's just – it's so unfair, especially, you know, these were – baby animals, you know, it just, they were just innocents. But also, you know, it goes both ways. The rage was against myself too, right? Yeah. I didn't build a pen that was strong enough to keep out the predator. So in some ways it was just, it was as much my fault as this innocent opossum. You know, later I sort of regret killing this opossum. But you know, you can't, when you get caught up in a rage, it's hard to shake.
Well, it's so honest. I mean, the way you talk about it. And I wonder, you know, it's one thing to write a book about it where you reveal this rage and then later the sense of regret you have. But you also, you know, have written a blog, which not so long ago you've talked about how you're not entirely crazy about writing the blog, or haven't been, at least from time to time. And so, I mean, I wonder what it's like to expose yourself. Yeah. You know, you get this feedback from people, written feedback, who don't understand it or maybe do and just don't like it. I mean, what's the difference in those two experiences? Well, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. Well, my life's changed a lot since the book came out. So, you know, Farm City came out in hardcover in 2009, and you know, I was sort of like, oh, wow, I really expected to go on book tour and have blood thrown at me, and, you know, be attacked and stuff. But what I found is a lot of vegetarians or vegans came up to me after a reading and bought the book and said they understood where I was coming from, and that this was, to them, in their opinion, if you are going to eat meat, this is the only way to eat meat. But then when the paperback came out, it became more mainstream. So, you know, people recognize me in the street now as the girl who raised the turkey for Thanksgiving. And then it opened, of course, because as things become more open, it opened it up to differing points of view. So I have a lot of people who are, you know, very oh, how can I say this in a nice
passionate
way? Because I don't want to. I'm passionate about not killing any animal, and that any kind of death is totally wrong. And you know, of course, I have arguments that again, you know, trying to say, hey, if you want to farm, you really need animals around.
Yeah.
You know, and it's sort of something that we have to have. And I would be horrified if all of a sudden we just started eating only tofu and lab-raised meat or something, because I like this relationship that I get to have with the animals. You know, it's very complicated, and it's animals make people human. And so if we divorce ourselves, and it's mostly people from the city, of course, that are, you know, writing these things on my blog, like, oh, you shouldn't eat meat and you're evil. And I've gotten some very disturbing threats. So, you know, that kind of stuff, you're sort of like, wow, you really live in a world that is completely divorced of nature. It has nothing to do with reality. It's great. You go to the store. You don't think about anything about where your food comes from because, you know, you think, all right, I'm just eating some tofu. No worries. You know, you don't have to think about an animal that died. Of course, you know, they're ignoring the fact that, you know, many moles are killed as they till up the fields to plant the soybeans and all these things. So, and also that, you know, we need animal manure to grow crops, basically. So those are the, you know, the issues that I sort of grapple with. It's so complicated. And then I have a blog and I have people that are the haters, as I call them. And it's hard. You know, after a while, you're just like, wow, you know, it used to be fun to write this blog because then I just get, you know, comments from other people or, you know, here's an idea. How about you do this instead of just sort of this like hatred. And so the blog has been a sore point for me. And, you know, it's sort of like the opossum. It's I've had a rage against it as well because city officials read my blog and I've gotten into trouble because of that. So it's sort of it's not a useful tool for me anymore.
Right. Well, I want to get to that, actually, because it's interesting that what you've been through with the city. But, you know, when you're going back to losing something or the idea of death, you know, it's not just the animals. I have to say there was a section where you talk about losing this watermelon, which seemed just crushing, you know?
It was crushing. There's crops to be lost as well. Of course, this watermelon was probably enjoyed by a neighborhood person. So I sort of – that made it a little bit better for me. But it was a burn, you know. You know, we can't really grow that many watermelons in Oakland. It's not that hot. So I usually only get one per plant. And I had nurtured this thing and waited, and I was so excited. It was my first watermelon ever. And then one day you just go out and it's gone. Mm. So, yeah, it really does. It does hurt. There's a lot of loss on when you farm. It's just part of what it is. It's not, you know, people have this whole romantic ideal of what it is. But there's a lot of losing things and dealing with how what that means for you. Like, are you a bad farmer? You know, should you have picked the watermelon earlier?
Yeah.
And all these things, you know, there's a sort of blame thing that happens. But then when you start talking to other urban farmers, you just feel so much better because they're like, oh, yeah, same thing happened to me, you know, and you learn. And this is part of what life is and what farming is learning how to do something better and moving on.
Well, it seems also one of the themes here almost is that, at least that I got, was that you only really have so much control over this stuff anyway.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, that's farming is a thing that makes you realize you have no control in your life whatsoever. Of course, my circumstances were very tenuous. I'm on a squatted piece of land, you know, and that makes it a little bit more difficult for sure. But, you know, there's weather. There's especially now there's so many weather events that are happening that are affecting farmers worldwide. And I can see how people can become religious as farmers. You have to sort of like, who is in control? Who is in charge? And it's a feeling of helplessness, but at the same time, it's this feeling of, for me, what's important is just knowing that, you know, having that sense of, yeah, you can't control your life. We will all die. we don't know how we'll die, but it's going to happen. And so it's these important lessons, meditations really, on how to live.
That's Novella Carpenter with us. Her book, Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer, it's out in paperback. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with Novella Carpenter about her book, Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. You know, Novella, we were talking earlier, you were talking about the watermelon and the thing that gave you some comfort, even though you weren't able to enjoy it. You figured somebody had.
Yeah.
Which seems like that's part of the point for all of this. I mean, because you get this question all the time. Look, why a city? Why Oakland? Why not? You know, you can find land in a lot of rural places, but the urban point, the idea of being in a city was was the community part, right? The sharing part. That was it for
mm-hmm.
you.
Yeah, you know, the lot, because we squatted on it for so long, you know, of course we couldn't lock a gate right. or anything like that. It was sort of this idea, an experiment in a public garden that mostly I was going to be farming. And so the gate, we had a gate, open gate policy, obviously. So anyone could really come into the garden, and the people still do come into the garden regularly to harvest stuff. And I remember the first time I saw someone doing, you know, picking some carrots or something out of my garden, I was kind of pissed, you know. I was like, hey, don't touch my carrots. And so I run downstairs and you know, the person is having this like almost religious experience picking these carrots because it reminds him of his grandmother. And I have to tell you, this happens constantly. You know, people come by. I had a woman come by the other day from Kenya, and she's like, girl, oh my God, I can't believe it. You're growing these like certain collard greens that they grow there. And, you know, so then I just like, I want her to pick some. Like, it would be disturbing if she did not take some collard greens home with her. And so, you know, I keep bags around, and people come by and harvest stuff all the time. And yeah, I guess that's sort of why I learned to love urban farming so much is, you know, if you live in a rural area, then it's kind of like a secret, you know, your garden, your farm is sort of for you to know about and not anyone else. But in a city of 500,000 people, you know, pretty soon the word spreads about this garden, and people want to come see it, and people want to hang out in the garden, and they want to harvest stuff. And a lot of it is not even about eating. It's about sort of telling me about their culture and about how they grow stuff. And so I've learned so much. The garden has become a place for conversations about culture and you know, different farming methods that people have used in the past. And so I really find it I find that comforting, and I get a lot of energy. I get more out of it than I give, really. When I load up someone with some turnips and I know that they're going to take those home and just really enjoy them, I think I'm getting more out of the deal than they are, really, because I just love this idea of a farm to grow food. Farming is to grow food for others. It's not just for yourself. And it's true in a rural area, I could bring boxes down or, you know, something like that. But there's no connection because people can't see it, you know. And so especially kids, you know, kids in my neighborhood, they don't even, you know, they didn't even know what a chicken looked like or that chickens lay eggs, things like that. And so it's so nice to be able to share that information with people in this like really hands on way instead of being like, oh, yeah, you have to go all the way to the, you know, let's get in a bus and we'll drive 2 hours, you know, north or something to show you the country or to show you where food is grown. And urban farming makes it so everyone can see where food is grown.
Well, and you talk about this idea of squatting on a piece of land, you know, planting crops for in these common areas. It's kind of part of our history.
Exactly. That's the thing is, you know, people think, oh, this is really, really weird behavior. but if you go back and look at American history, I mean, there used to be the commons, you know, people would share their pasture areas for raising cows or hogs or other things. It's only, you know, now that we've sort of gotten this idea of like property value and really wanting to everyone have their name on a deed and own property, that we've gotten kind of caught up into this thing of who owns that. And to me, West Oakland has so many abandoned lots where food could be grown, and then people are hungry at the same time. So it's kind of a no-brainer to me. Mm-hmm. It just makes sense. Of course, we'd want to use that land. Like, how greedy is it to just hold land and not use it at all?
You know, it seems like there's this balance that you came to about what you could and couldn't do and what you should and shouldn't eat. I mean, you seem to have kind of had this sense that you've got to create some kind of balance, because there's this point where you take a pledge to only eat from the garden. Like, I think it was just July. You figured, all right, in July, I'm going to try to only eat from the garden. I think you called it your 100-yard diet, I think is how you described it.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, what did you – talk about that experience and what you learned from that experience.
Well, I lost a lot of weight, actually. For some reason, July was like the worst month to choose because it's really like spring's over, but summer hasn't really started yet. Yeah. But, you know, I thought July because like independence, you know, 4th of July and stuff like that. And I hadn't planned very well. But basically, I decided, you know, what am I doing? Like, people would be like, oh, well, how much food do you really grow? And I get this question all the time. You know, what percentage of your diet is from your garden? And so I wanted to find out, well, okay, I bet I could really live off of just what I grow. I planted some potatoes and things like that and went for it. And what I found was that I really was missing carbohydrates. That was what I missed so much. You know, I had plenty of zucchini and, you know, lettuce, but honestly, if you want to feel full, you need some carbs or some meat. And I didn't have a lot of meat at the time. And it was a real lesson. And it was humbling, but at the same time, I was so attuned to the garden. You know, I knew every single beet. I had basically counted it, yeah. You know, because I was like, okay, I'm going to eat that one on Wednesday. Mm. And this sort of idea of this idea, you know, there's a sense of abundance, right? You go to the grocery store, there's so much food everywhere. And all of a sudden I had this sense of there was abundance, but it was also this sort of like it was definitely huge. You know, it wasn't like a grocery store. Let's just say that I was just only going to get to eat the certain things. It was like, OK, I'm going to grate up this pumpkin and like, you know, fry up some things and like, thank God I have some honey. And so I really kind of suffered. But it was a good way. It was a good way to sort of see what it would be like. You know, people are always talking about the apocalypse and what's going to happen and how you're going to have to live off your vegetables. And it's not, in my case, in this July stunt, it wasn't necessarily the most healthful time. But, you know, since then, I've done another one where I've been like, okay, I'm going to try the 100-yard diet again. But, you know, I have goats now. Yeah. And so it was basically like I was eating Chev all day long. It was like the Chev diet. I think I gained weight. You know, it was just ridiculous. So, but anyway, that was a lesson that I learned is that, you know, really – you can live off the small amount of land if you choose to. And, you know, people like Joan Gusso, you know, who wrote this amazing book about being the suburban farmer, basically. She does the same thing on an even smaller piece of property. She eats almost entirely her own diet, food that she grows herself. So it is possible.
You've talked about how the goats now – although it's not necessarily part of the book, but that was kind of a reaction to the fact that you may have gone a little bit overboard with the pigs before, right?
I mean, you think? I'm glad you read it like that because a lot of people come up to me and they're like, I'm thinking about raising pigs. I read your book. And I'm like, did you read the book? Because no, don't do it. Raising pigs was a lot of work. But, you know, it's sort of like, you know, the way that I had stopped being a vegetarian is that I had eaten a bunch of bacon, which, I mean, I know vegetarians that have a bacon clause in their sort of agreement with themselves so they can still eat bacon, which, yeah. You know, and so it's a complicated meat, but I figured, oh, I'll just, you know, I'll raise some pigs, partially because my boyfriend and I had been doing a lot of dumpster diving. After we raised Harold, we had done a cost analysis to kind of figure out, like, how much did that Thanksgiving turkey cost us? Right. And it was, like, probably over $100 in feed because he just ate like crazy. And so we had to figure out a way to start having a more cost-effective way of feeding the animals. And I started that's when I really got into tapping the waste stream of the city. And so we started dumpster diving, basically, to feed the, you know, the rabbits and the chickens. And as we were dumpster diving, we would find food that I was kind of like, God, I don't know if anyone would eat that. And, you know, my partner Bill said, yeah, I think, you know, there's enough food in here to like feed a pig. And, you know, when you say it out loud, all of a sudden, you know, I'm looking at a poster that's like for the swine auction in Mendocino. And there we were buying two of these little piglets and then raising them on dumpster scraps. Yeah. You know, it's sort of a and the idea there was like, I'm not going to spend a dime on these pigs. I've learned from the turkey experience. What we didn't know is that how much food these pigs would eat. By the end, they were eating 9 buckets, like 5-gallon buckets of food a day. And so we really had to expand our dumpster diving horizons. Let's just say that.
you mentioned this Portuguese saying that the happiest times in life are the first year of marriage and the week after you butcher a pig.
Yeah. You know, there was the amount of just the plenty is incredible.
Yeah.
We had so much bacon and pork chops. And we had also done this, you know, Italian dry curing of a lot of the meat.
Yeah.
So we had to wait for that. But the fresh stuff was so amazing. And, you know, there was just this sense of like, oh, my God, I can't believe we did it. You know, we raise pigs. We have bacon that we made ourselves, you know, which was just an amazing feeling. And it was the best. It was literally the best pork I've ever had. And I haven't had any pork that was better since. And maybe it was because of that same idea, you know, mm-hmm. of that you had raised it yourself. And so you had this connection to it. But it was also that, you know, we had fed the pigs really well. And this was, of course, when we were raising the pigs, it was during the economic boom. So when we would go to the dumpster, we would find wheels of brie and, you know, whole things of ricotta, an entire dumpster of peaches. And so the pigs were fed this like really amazing, rich food. And then the pork oftentimes tastes like the food that you fed the animal. So it was really, really, really tasty. But a lot of work, and I don't think, you know, it was basically became a part-time job. That's why I don't recommend it to other people unless they're going to do it as a collective, you know, if you had like a group of people that raised it. And the other thing is like you are what you eat. I mean, Bill and I basically turned into pigs. I mean, we were eating so much pork chop. We would have to have parties just to sort of like, you know, let vent the meat process, you know, like, oh, my God, we've got this huge loin. What are we going to do? Let's invite a bunch of people over. And hams and all these things. And so it maybe wasn't the most healthful, you know, time of my life after post-pig.
Novella Carpenter is with us. Her book is called Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Novella Carpenter is joining us. We're talking about her book, Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. She's joining us from the School of Journalism at Berkeley. I wanted to ask you, Novella Carpenter, so you've had, Farm City, you revealed some struggles with the city, but you mostly sort of flew under the radar for a lot of that. And it's become, I guess once the book came out, once you started writing the blog, now, the city officials learned about it. And I wonder, and first of all, do you ever regret that going public? You know, you kind of ruined a good thing in some ways.
I know, Doug. God, don't tell me that. Yeah, no, I do regret it, actually. I've actually had this guy wrote to me, and he's like, I've been doing what you've been doing for 20 years, and I just never told anyone about it. You know, I just, it was very subtle. And I realized this is a character flaw on my part, is that I love to tell people about what I'm doing, you know, and to a fault, you know, I shouldn't tell everyone what I'm up to, especially when those activities are considered illegal. But, you know, I thought, oh, Oakland, you know, it's totally this sort of like anarchy place anyway. What happened was, you know, as a book got popular, the Oakland complaint line started getting these calls from vegans, and mostly it was people that were raise rabbits. There are these house rabbit society people, and they would get calls, and people would read from Farm City over the complaint line.
Wow.
And you know, I went and actually talked to city officials after I had gotten in trouble. And to find out, you know, what was going on. And they said, listen, we all knew about you. You know, we all read your book. But basically, when we started getting these complaints, you know, and we were getting a lot of complaints, I think there had been a phone tree sort of put in place where it was like, let's call Oakland and bust Novella.
Yeah.
Then that's when they finally just had to send someone over to, you know, to inspect my operation. And the weird thing about Oakland is that they have a law that says you can't actually grow food on an empty lot. If there's not a house on the property, you're not supposed to be growing food or raising food, doing agricultural activities,
but
raising livestock.
See, that doesn't make any sense. And you talked about the fact that a lot of these rules, there's this kind of dualism between the city and the farm. And there's this kind of – some of these laws, you say, you've learned could be kind of anti-immigrant in some ways.
Well, some of them are, you know, it's sort of like this idea where people – it was kind of in the 50s and 60s when people are kind of trying to figure out what is a city. And they were like, well, it certainly isn't growing food. It certainly isn't raising chickens. And there is an element of that because so many people from different countries come to America and you know, it's normal to have chickens in your backyard in, you know, certain African countries or Asian countries. And so, you know, they start raising chickens. And so there is this sort of element of, no, this is America. You know, we buy our meat. We buy our eggs and these kinds of things. And so that's what was going on in the 50s when they were sort of trying to figure out what a city is. And there was also a sense of, you know, this cleanliness and that if there were animals in the city, it was going to be really dirty. And it's just not true. I mean, so many people now have backyard chickens and they have these beautiful coops and lovely chickens. And, you know, they're probably living in better conditions than most people around the world, these chickens. So, but anyway, so there, that was sort of a sense of what was going on back then. And now, of course, the laws are changing and people are like, you know, coming up with in Seattle, you know, for instance, they just made it legal to, start selling products from your house, basically, that you grow yourself and, you know, can or jar up. Because there is a sense of, oh, there's actually an economic reason for growing your own food. It's less expensive. Or maybe you can start a little home business. And so luckily that's starting to that paradigm is shifting, thank God.
Well, you in one of your blogs, you write about the fact that the issue's about the control of the food system, like that somehow we're not – somehow people who – have backyard lots aren't supposed to be in control or something.
Well, I mean, maybe it's a little conspiracy theory, but yeah, no, that's a huge issue is if you can't control where you, and this is Will Allen, you know, the most famous urban farmer that exists from Milwaukee and Growing Power. Food is power. If you can grow your own food, you can exist. And this is something that's, it's not just for, you know, dabblers or hobby farmers. This is like a real deal. Like people have seen, especially in places like West Oakland, where there's a large African American community, if you can't control the food system, if you have to like accept charity or go buy your food at this crappy place with, you know, drenched in chemicals, then you're giving up your power of you know, control of your life, basically. And so that's why I'm concerned about these laws, because really they disempower people. And especially in places like my neighborhood, it's really stupid to disempower people because of the economic problems that are happening. So to me, it's just idiotic, really.
Novella Carpenter is with us. Let me get another few conversations, voices involved in the conversation. Joining us here in the studio is Rachel Hodson and David Vogel. They're the publishers of Edible Wasatch Magazine, which focuses on local and sustainable food in Utah. It's published seasonally, and they're joining us here. And Rachel and David, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So when you're listening to Novella Carpenter talk about this idea of food being power and about control, I'm guessing that resonates with you?
Strongly. I think, you know, it's really a basic life skill that you're talking about. And as the farmers have left our communities, this colloquial knowledge, which really was common knowledge, has left as well. And there are lots of us who don't know how to cook for ourselves, much less grow food for ourselves. So it's really critical that we are having these conversations right now and talking about how do we build these basic life skills in our cities, but also so we can pass them on to our children and continue to feed ourselves.
David, you guys have talked about how I think it was 9/11 sort of gave you some kind of epiphany about all of this, that the food system is fragile.
It did draw it into sharper relief in some ways. It's something that I had been thinking about for a long time prior to that. But to be on a concrete island with, you know, surrounded by millions of people and realizing you know, once the trucks stop running,
what happens?
What happens next? You know, and if you go, you know, to a place like New York City now, there are so many people working really hard at finding all kinds of innovative and creative ways to make the city itself more productive and to make the regional food shed more appropriate so that it's not as fragile.
You know, we were talking before with Novella about the fact that well, and Rachel used the word sort of this used to be a common knowledge. Talk about the history, like in Utah, for example, this idea of common space to grow crops. It's part of this place as well.
It's a huge part of this place. You know, we're surrounded by all of these mountain ranges. And before the railroads and certainly the trucks started running, people didn't have any other option but to be really self-sufficient. And the Mormon pioneers literally built their communities around these ideas of feeding, you know, sharing strength in terms of diversity and in terms of the communal aspect of growing food together. I mean, Novella addressed that beautifully earlier on, that there were commons where people would share this work of, you know, growing the things that we really now consider commonplace, but really at that time were luxuries. It was a luxury to have a pig and to slaughter it and to have that bacon. And we were more grateful for those things. And these cities in Utah have that literally built right into the infrastructure. Joseph Smith said that he wanted the farmers to have the experience of society, and now we're experiencing a reversal where by bringing the farms back into urban environments, people can have the benefit of the farm.
Mm. So, Novella, I wanted to talk about just some – I know the memoir isn't about the basics. You've written a book now about the basics. So, Rachel and David, I want you to help me with this as well here. So if people are thinking about it, where do they start? I guess for you, one of the big messages is, look, start small. Don't bite off too much.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, so many people get kind of like caught up in it, and this is very much like our world, right? Like, oh, I'm obsessed with this band, so I'm going to buy every, you know, album or whatever. But people can do that with like farm animals too. I've actually seen this where they're like, I'm getting turkeys and rabbits and chickens tomorrow. And you're like, oh boy. So my rule is one animal per year. Basically, it takes that long, 1 year to sort of like know that animal and do a good job with it before you move on to the next thing. And also, try to do something with other people. I think a lot of times, you know, people are like into that independent farmer, like the lone wolf out there. Mm-hmm. But you kind of need help and especially if you don't know how to farm. So finding a mentor of some sort is always really helpful as well.
And how do you, David and Rachel, how in particular, how do you negotiate your way around like zoning laws and regulations and stuff like that? I mean, you have to educate yourself, I suppose. Right?
You do. And there's, you know, there's a lot of legislation out there that's being debated now. And one of the real benefits of urban farming is that it brings a larger number of constituents into that conversation. And we need to remember that as Americans, we contribute to our own democracy in the way that our cities are built and the laws that govern them. And so the more people that there are engaged in these kinds of ideas, then there's going to be more dialogue around it. And we do, in some ways, in the city, need to take responsibility and speak for our rural farmers, who are such a small percentage of our population now. So definitely, I mean, I'm with Novella on the sometimes it's better to beg forgiveness than ask permission, because in part you need to be demonstrating that it's possible. So the first animal that you might get on your little urban farm might be red wiggler worms, and you could be feeding them their compost and then putting that right back into your garden and getting, you know, and that would be legal. Okay.
And there has been some really positive movement, at least in Salt Lake and South Salt Lake recently, to make it a little bit more accessible for people from a legal perspective to return to the roots of the city and to start to explore those things in terms of bees and chickens and some things like that. So it's, you know, things are moving in the right direction. It's not as radical maybe as it was once perceived by the municipal governments and people that are concerned with their, you know, property values and all those kinds of legitimate, you know, issues.
Yeah. I wonder if I want to go back to this question of identity, Novella. I mean, because in some ways this is where you end up in the book is, you know, you realize, look, I'm a – whatever else I am, I'm a farmer too, right?
Yeah. And that's – You know, and you know, I love that you guys mentioned the rural farmers, because people have this image that, like, it's like this duality, same thing, like urban farmers versus rural farmers or something. And it's totally not like that. I mean, I worship rural farmers because, honestly, they're mm-hmm. the ones that are growing most of the food. Like, let's mm-hmm. face it, we're like 1% or less. Honoring that tradition of being a farmer is really important. And, you know, there's a sense of, like, maybe now it's becoming more trendy or cool to be a farmer, but it's a lot of hard work and you're dealing with a lot of manure and it's not really glamorous. But just to know that, you know, I'm part of this tradition, I'm part of this this group of people that grows food and knows how to grow food is empowering. And it gives you a role in the community instead of, like, what am I doing? I sit in front of a computer all day. And it's a nice, it's a, just a good way to sort of remember your roots. And this is what most, and it's not just like because I had hippie parents. It's like people, humans are, that's what we do. We grow food. We're agriculturalists. And that's what this whole country is based on, the agricultural nation. And so returning to those roots is very comforting.
Rachel and David, so if people want mentors, they want information, where do they go?
I think the simplest and most direct place to go is just the farmer's market, you know, because you will be actually talking to people who grow the food.
And just have conversations.
I mean, some of it is just asking questions. I want to speak to just something that Novella just said that's really important, which is that there's this really fragile human component in the United States right now, less than 2% of our population producing all the food that we eat. And we're exporting a lot of that food, too. So some of it is keeping the farmland in production here in the United States and certainly in Utah. And some of it is really sending support to the people who are literally feeding us. And we can do that by, you know, the solidarity of growing a tomato and developing some appreciation for how difficult that is. You know, it's an incredible service that they're giving us. So going and talking to them at the farmer's market and supporting them with your dollars. You know, if a farmer out on the land has sold their produce to a distribution company, they're getting something like 19 cents or less on the dollar. If you go and buy from them at the farmer's market, they get that dollar, and their operation cost comes out of it. But you're really supporting something that feeds us, literally.
Mm. Well, so are you – Novella, is it true you're going to take the summer off?
Yeah, I'm taking the summer off. Well, I have to because I had to apply for this conditional use permit.
Yeah.
So then I was like, wait a minute, I'm so tired. because, you know, the battle with the city was, like, really exhausting. I felt like the hand of God had come down and shut me down. So anyway, I'm taking the summer off, but I'm sure – but it's good, too, because it doesn't rain in the summer, so
right,
it'll be
right.
Nice.
Good. Novella Garbender, her book is called Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. It's out in paperback right now. Novella, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you. It's awesome.
Rachel and David, thank you both very much. We'll put links, by the way, to Edible Wasatch Magazine on our website. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.